dark secrets.
Hey there, I'm Amy Smith.
And I'm LaDonna Humphrey. Welcome to Deep Dark Secrets, a podcast that shines a light in some really dark places.
Today, we will continue our discussion of a child sex trafficking ring, and we're going to focus in on someone that we mentioned several episodes ago, Nathaniel Bar-Jonah.
Bar-Jonah, born David Paul Brown, began his criminal career quite young. In fact, when he was 7 years old, he lured a five-year-old girl into his basement. He told her that he had received a Ouija board for his birthday and that he could predict the future. Once she was in the basement, he began to choke the young girl. Thankfully, her screams attracted the attention of his mother, who came to the rescue. Then, in 1973, at the age of 15, Bar-Jonah cut letters and words out of magazines and composed a note that he used to attempt to entice two young boys from Webster to a cemetery. He offered them $20 as a surprise. Then, in May of 1974, in Woodstock, Connecticut, Mary Patrone, 10 years old, was abducted, raped, and released by Bar-Jonah. But he didn't stop there. In late March of 1975, while impersonating a police officer, he abducted 8-year-old Richard O'Connor, then proceeded to sexually assault and choke him. A neighbor happened to see what was going on. He called the police, and the boy was found near death after the attack.
His dangerous behavior didn't stop there. A few days before his high school graduation, he drove to nearby Hartford, Connecticut, and again, impersonating a police officer, he abducted a 9-year-old girl. However, after the child began vomiting and convulsing from the assault, he drove up to a sidewalk and he threw the girl out of the car. Then, on September 24th, 1977, he claimed to be an undercover FBI agent, and he convinced two boys leaving the White City Cinemas in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, to get into his vehicle. He transported these boys to a secluded area where he handcuffed and then tortured them. For this crime, Brown was convicted of attempted murder and received the maximum sentence of 18 to 20 years at the Massachusetts Correctional Institution.
On March 22nd of 1984, Brown changed his name to Nathaniel Benjamin Levi Bar-Jonah. So you will notice that we kind of go back and forth in the beginning of this episode calling him Brown or Bar-Jonah, but technically, before he died, he was Nathaniel Bar-Jonah. Later in that same year of 1984, Bar-Jonah, along with two psychologists that had evaluated him, won a parole hearing after the psychologist testified that Bar-Jonah was no longer a threat to society. Superior Court Judge Walter Steele ruled that Massachusetts had failed to prove that Bar-Jonah was dangerous and ordered him released on February 12th of 1991. Administrative issues prevented Bar-Jonah's release until July of that year. And during this time, Bar-Jonah confided in his psychiatrist that he fantasized about abducting, murdering, and cannibalizing children. So I just want to make that clear. A judge ordered him released in February. There was some administrative issues, like I mentioned. And so during that entire time between February and July, he was confiding in psychiatrists about wanting to harm children, and they did nothing.
Wow.
On August 9th, 1991, just a month after being released from Bridgewater Hospital, Bar-Jonah saw a 7-year-old boy sitting alone in a car outside of a post office in Oxford, Massachusetts. Bar-Jonah entered the car illegally and sat on the boy's chest. He did so in an attempt to kill him. He was arrested, and at first, Bar-Jonah claimed that he entered the car to get out of the rain. But he later admitted that he intended to kill the boy. For the attack, Bar-Jonah was given permission by the county district attorney to enter a guilty plea to assault and battery in exchange for a 2-year probationary period and the promise that he would move to Great Falls, Montana to live with his mother.
Wow. I mean, you could see that coming a mile away.
And they just didn't want him to be their problem. They sent him to Montana.
Gosh, you know, they could have stopped a lot right there. but they let him walk.
Well, it's disgusting that those psychiatrists that heard his fantasies between, you know, February and July didn't come forward. He should have never been released.
Mm-mm. I mean, I realize, you know, the confidentiality, but they could have stopped several incidents if they had just kept him there and treated him.
Yeah, he needed to be locked up for the rest of his life, but I completely agree.
Do you know why he changed his name? I was just curious.
Yes, there's a big backstory there. He wanted to change his name so he could pretend to be Jewish because he wanted to know what it was like to be persecuted as a Jew.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I know a lot about Bar-Jonah. Okay, I wish I didn't, but I've spent several years investigating this guy. Was going to go and interview him in prison before he died, and you know, he died before I got to do that. But yeah, I know a lot about him. He was just sick. He was one sick dude.
Yeah, I knew you had did a lot of research on him. And that's why I thought, well, was the name change to hide or was it something more bizarre, as you already said? I mean,
it was bizarre.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, well, let's fast forward to February 6th of 1996. When a 10-year-old Zach Ramsey left an apartment that he lived at with his mother. He headed to school, but he never arrived. A witness who lived near the end of the alleyway reported seeing Ramsey crying with an obese adult male following him just a few feet behind at around 7:45 a.m. A witness who personally knew Bar-Jonah reported seeing him standing beside a dumpster in an alleyway around 7:15 while taking out his trash. He was wearing a navy blue police-like jacket. The same witness also reported seeing Ramsey near that same alleyway and that Bar-Jonah was still standing beside that dumpster. This case went cold until December 13th of 1999, when Bar-Jonah was seen outside an elementary school for the third time in 1 week. He was wearing a dark blue jacket and a knit cap and was carrying two cans of pepper spray, a toy gun, and a badge. He was arrested for impersonating a police officer and for carrying a concealed weapon. A judge approved a search warrant on December 15th of 99, and it was for Bar-Jonah's mother's house. And in there, they found two coats, one dark blue, and another with a toy badge in the pocket, and a second toy badge, a stun gun, and a baseball cap reading security enforcement. They also found a pulley on the ceiling of Bar-Jonah's kitchen, along with two albums containing cutouts of children. And that whole scenario just creeps me out. I mean, he's got the law enforcement stuff all the way to a container having cutouts of children.
Yeah, he was the ultimate definition of a predator. And I think he was just honing his craft over the years. I mean, like I said earlier, he started when he was about 7 years old, and it just went on and on and on and on, and his crimes became more and more severe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it got worse and worse as he went.
Well, 2 days later, a second search warrant was granted for Bar-Jonah's house for documents and photographic material. And so while searching Bar-Jonah's apartment, detectives found a list of 54 boys. These names were labeled Lake Webster, which were later identified as boys that Bar-Jonah knew from his youth in Massachusetts.
Wow.
Including three names of boys whom Bar-Jonah was convicted of abducting in the mid-1970s. And they also found the name Zachary Ramsey, followed by the word died.
Wow.
Yeah. Additionally, law enforcement found dozens of newspaper clippings in Bar-Jonah's apartment following the Ramsey case, as well as 3,500 photographs of children and undeveloped film containing sexual images of Bar-Jonah and three unidentified boys. All that was recovered. This sounds like a recipe for child sex trafficking.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my stomach just dropped when I read about the Zachary Ramsey and the word died. I mean, you know, a cold case that had been cold for so long, and then all of a sudden just this name randomly appears in all of this information. I just can't imagine his mama reading that information and what her mind could have went to.
Oh, no, I can't imagine either. And, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg on what they found. They also found a bunch of recipes because he was a cannibal. And one was called Little Boy Stew. Ugh. They found all kinds of references to cannibalism. But not only that, they also found bones and things on his property. And so, you know, it was pretty clear to them that he had been abducting children and possibly cannibalizing them. And so that's what makes this even more horrific. But it's also interesting in a way because this kind of ties over to like the death fetish topic that we had in our first season. And as you know, a lot of those death fetishers that got arrested for murder, they found child porn and other materials in their homes, on their computers, and it's like it goes hand in hand. So I think that's pretty telling about Barjona.
Yeah, absolutely. He was right there in the mix of all the other ones.
Yeah, and you know, and on top of that, you know, he was a big supporter for NAMBLA. I mean, he really believed in NAMBLA, and you know, he traveled all across the United States, which, you know, makes that even scarier because, you know, what was he doing? Was he setting up NAMBLA chapters? You know, one of the things that interested me is that he was in Arkansas in 1995, right before Morgan Nick was abducted. And he was actually looked at in her abduction because, you know, he preferred little boys, but he took boys and girls and hurt them. And he was in Fort Smith, and it's always just been pretty intriguing to me that he was there. He had been writing with a woman, like pen pals, and had convinced her that, you know, he wanted to move in with her. And she agreed to it because she thought this was going to be some sort of great guy who was going to help her raise her children. But he was really targeting her for her small children.
Wow. Do you know how many kids that they think are connected to Barjona?
Hundreds and hundreds. They will never know for sure.
Ugh, that is just, that is heartbreaking.
It is. There's some books out there that I've read. It's a series of books. They're very graphic about things that Barjona had done. And he was just disgusting. Everything from his, you know, disgusting lack of hygiene to the fact that he was into child molestation and child pornography and, you know, murder and cannibalism. And he was just sick. He was really, really sick.
Wow. Well, join us next week as we continue to explore the life of Barjona, a card-carrying member of NAMBLA, sex trafficking young boys. I'm sure you won't want to miss it because I know LaDonna's done a lot of research on him. Tune in next week as we dig deeper into Barjona, NAMBLA, and their connections to trafficking. Until then, stay safe and remember, keep your lights on.
For exclusive content from this episode and other episodes, head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/deepdarksecrets. Sign up and you will receive Deep Dark Secrets merchandise, extra episodes, and much more. For more information about our podcast, visit deepdarksecretspodcast.com.